The Tom Woods Show, episode 617.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, if you're interested in more libertarian podcasts, then check out the Jason Stapleton program, hosted by my friend Jason Stapleton. He gives you a libertarian take on the news Monday through Friday. Check it out at jasonstapleton.com. Hey, everybody, if you're listening to this on March 14th, 2016, then tomorrow is the webinar starring Sarah Young, the mom of seven who became an expert affiliate marketer, learning how to make an income from home. And she's going to teach you how she does it in this webinar tomorrow. And for every live attendee, I'm donating $5 to the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Register at tomwoods.com/Sarah. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. What a great episode we have today because, of course, we are joined by Ron Paul, as promised, the 12-term congressman, presidential candidate, and number one New York Times best-selling author, is here to answer listener questions that I solicited in the show's private Facebook group. Entry is through supportinglisteners.com, and I'm glad to welcome Dr. Paul to the show right now. Ron, thanks for being here.
Tom, nice to be with you again.
All right, I've got to ask you something. I've got a bunch of listener questions, but as the host, I'm entitled to ask you something. And I just want to know, has there been a time since you retired from Congress that you either said to yourself, I do miss such and such about being a congressman, or that you said to yourself, darn it, I wish I could be on the House floor denouncing this thing?
No, I don't do any of that. So I have no longing desire to be back there. The best test of that is I've gone back to D.C. twice in the last 3.5 years since I've been out, and I did not visit the Hill. I had a visit, you know, and a meeting elsewhere. No, I'm not. I still long for the discussion, and that is, of course, why I stay active and have my website and have my internet program. And I do always want to do that, but to do that on the House floor and even looking at these debates and things going on, it's rather disgusting, you know. I think. And I've often said, you know, one thing I told my staff when I was in Washington is some of them were, you know, interested in legislation. Now, I introduced a lot of legislation, but I wasn't interested in legislating. I said, I'd remind my staff, I am not a legislator. I have not come here to pass laws, you know, because I wasn't, I was realistic that what we're talking about is the reform and educate and change society and understanding, but not to tinker around. And the other thing is if you get one piece of legislation passed and you work the system, they say, okay, we're going to let your bill come up and we're going to pass it. Then they claim you owe them something. And so that was never any fun. But I long still for the debate, but I do not long for the debate in Washington anymore. I had my chance. A couple people listened, and I did some campaigning, and a few more listened. So I'm content to continue to do my best I can with the facilities I have now.
I'm going to be linking to all the stuff that you're working on, the Ron Paul Liberty Report, all that stuff. So let's see. This is actually episode 617. So tomwoods.com/617. I'm going to link to everything because it's all great stuff that you're working on. The Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, is just so much great stuff going on. All right. Now, I specifically told my listeners I am not asking him things that I know what his answer is. We're going to ask you things you've never been asked before in your career. Okay? So how about this one? I know you've got your Liberty Report, things you're doing now, that you're doing because everybody knows who Ron Paul is. But suppose they didn't. Suppose you'd been an OBGYN and you were retired today. If you weren't famous, what would you be doing to spread the message of liberty?
Well, it would be a token effort because there was a time when I was fascinated with the issue, but I had no bully pulpit. And, you know, the political activity and being in Congress gave me a bit of a a bully pulpit. So without it, what I did was in the 60s, I participated mostly in trying to learn more. I was a very dedicated follower of Leonard Reed and Fee Foundation and did a lot of visiting at Fee, because I thought the first part, and I agreed with Leonard on this so much, was that you have to improve oneself and learn and study. And then I always thought, well, someday I'm going to, I want to voice this opinion. Matter of fact, that is the reason I drifted over into the political sphere, because it wasn't so much to run for Congress and be in Congress. I ran in 1974 in the midst of a political crisis, with the Republicans. But it was also the follow-up from the breakdown of Bretton Woods. And I knew that, just speaking out without an intent to be in politics. But I would have gone any place, any time to visit in the early years. But and quite frankly, if you're an OB doctor and nobody's ever heard of you, you're not going to be invited to speak any place. I mean, some are successful at that, and they can develop a reputation. But at that time, it didn't seem to be available to me. So I did drift into using the political system to get attention, but I believe that I was using that system quite differently than others have, because they get enamored by the fact that, oh, could I be a congressman, and then all of a sudden, could I be famous, and could I get this law passed, or could I be a chairman of a committee? And then even though there were so many that I knew over the years that were well-intended and well-motivated, that they drifted away shortly after they got to Washington.
I want to ask you also, I think this is another listener question, but I was going to ask you anyway. Over the course of your career, can you think of a vote that you regret? Now, not necessarily because you changed your mind later about the vote, like you thought you were wrong, but it could also be you were right about the vote, but yet the thing turned out badly, not the way you expected it to. So was there anything that you look back on and say, well, maybe that was a mistake?
Not really. There was one that can raise some questions, but I can still use the same justification. But, I did get a lot of help, and you're familiar enough with legislation that sometimes it's very complex. It's not easy that it's all right and all wrong and this sort of thing. And sometimes you can get, let's say you're cutting spending, sometimes you're raising taxes and cutting spending, and you say, well, I got to figure this out. Are we raising more taxes than we're cutting on spending, or vice versa? So I'd work that out. And with help, I was able to do that. And I was never, upset about having, gone one way or the other. But I think the one vote that people might bring up, even though less so now because a lot of people are recognizing the abuse of the law, and that had to do with the emergency powers to deal with the people who bombed the Al-Qaeda and the bombing on 9/11.
Yeah.
And I did vote for the authority. And it's one of these things. I know what caused it. I know what it was. But, if you don't have a little bit of response to that, then I think it's stepping over to being a total anarchist. And although I keep moving in that direction, I still wasn't there. I think it would be similar to, what do you do after the Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor? And, it's pretty hard not to, retaliate. But it would have been easy for me to retaliate against Japan a little bit differently. But anyway, I voted for this authority, but it has been so abused. They're still using it. They're using it to go to in every country. They're using it against ISIS. I get my authority from the use of military force from 2001.
Yeah.
And that is so abusive, because it said it's very narrow. You go after the people who contributed to 9/11. Well, I doubt very much if many of them are alive right now who were directly involved with 9/11. But the abuse, I should have known, but I don't know if it would have changed my vote or not. But it emphasizes, how terrible the system is, that even if you try to do something and try to narrow it down, but we're at a point now where our presidents do whatever they want. Now they don't even pretend anymore. There's we fight preventive wars, and we never ask Congress for anything. They abuse it. So even if you have an authority to use military force, it's irrelevant. you know, if you pass it or not. And the ongoing argument now is whether or not they should have a new, authority for using military force. Totally irrelevant, because just look at how many places we go and they don't even discuss it with the Congress, let alone letting the people know what's going on.
I had a guy on my show, before I ask you depressing questions about the election, I had a guy on my show some time ago, Hal Elrod. He wrote a book called The Miracle Morning. And he said that his whole life was changed when he got up early in the morning and he had a healthy morning routine. He'd exercise. He would eat. He would read a success book for a little while. He would meditate, whatever. And he said that so many successful people have these very regimented morning routines. So somebody asked me, what's Ron Paul's morning routine?
Well,
see, I bet you've never been asked that before, have you?
No, not really. I think sometimes they'll say, well, you know, what are you going to talk about on your program or something like that, but the regime. And it's very, very annoying when I can't follow my regime, because I am conditioned for it and it's very good for me. So I tend to go to bed reasonably early. I usually sleep 8 hours and I wake up at 6 a.m. in the morning. And my immediate response is very, very important. I have a cup of coffee, and I think that is great. And I even use the television. I'll find out what the enemy's saying and flip through the stations. And I wake up, but then I go walking. And I go walking, and it's always by myself. Not always, but basically by myself. And I'll go and out. If time permits, if I don't have anything pressing, I will walk 4 miles. But the minimum I'll walk is 2 miles. If I only can walk 2 miles, then I know I have to walk faster to burn up the same amount of energy. And then I come back. And by that time, my mind is clear, and I'm ready to start either to write something or to prepare for our internet programming, or get prepared for a radio interview like the Tom Woods Show, because I really have to study up for the tough questions from Tom Woods.
There you go.
But then, you know, I do what I have to do, and I do get a fair number of interviews. For a while, I wasn't getting that many interviews on ordinary TV, but I get more now. But by afternoon, you know, I want to take a break, and my break is getting on my bike and riding my 10 miles or 12 miles or whatever. And I know it's good for my physical health, but I don't basically do it for that. I do it for my mental health. I think it's my tranquilizer, and it's a time for me to think and plan and take notes. And most time I keep thinking I should have my paper and pencil with me. I never remember to take it, but as soon as I finish my walk, I sometimes will rush to my desk and I say, that thought I have, I got to write it down. This is a good point. So that doesn't sound very exciting, but to me, when I can't do it, I know I'm not as happy as I am when I get to do my exercises.
Well, you know, even in this area, you have something to teach me. I should be doing that, and yet if I go out, if I even think about it, I think, but I could be spending this time writing or whatever, but it would be so good for my mental health. I do have to start doing that. All right, I got to ask you, there was a rumor when you were running for president that if you had gotten the nomination that you would have considered Walter Williams as a VP. Was there ever anything to that?
Yeah, I probably had said that because I've known Walter, and because it wasn't a realistic concern, you know, that I would. But no, I would. And, you know, the other person that I had mentioned was Jim Grant. And you know Jim Grant.
Oh, he would have been great.
Well, what I recommended to him was I was going to put him ahead of the Fed so he could close it down. But,
yeah,
you know,
I thought
he would, you know, I've known Jim for a long time, and I had him on my show not too long ago, and that subject came up, but he brought it up. And he seemed to have been flattered by it, and I thought, well, I didn't know that deserved that. But he sort of thought, you know, that was a positive thing, because he knew why we were talking about that. And, you know, and I do have a lot of respect for him. I mean, he is a very, very knowledgeable in monetary policy, a strong Austrian, and a real gold standard person. So it wasn't to be.
All right. Well, look, I got to ask you a little something having to do with Donald Trump, but I'm going to ask you something different. I want to ask about the shenanigans they're trying to pull on him. Now, I'm not a Trump supporter, and I know you signed a thing saying that you wouldn't support him, but of course you wouldn't support Rubio or Cruz either. But what's interesting to me are the lengths they're trying to go to stop him. And it, of course, it should remind you of what happened in 2012. The rules are going to be written to make sure that the outcome is the one the establishment wants. And the establishment clearly does not want the Trump outcome. I mean, as an observer, what are your thoughts about the Republican establishment and Trump?
Well, I don't get into the nitty-gritties and the details. I do have opinions about that, but people ask about, you know, what's it going to do to the Republican Party and this sort of thing. I really don't care.
Yeah.
And but when it comes to that, you know, the one thing that I do have concern about on how fast this statism is moving and the taking of our liberties is moving in a direction, I see that is something that would be the worst conditions would be to have one party in all three, you know, House, Senate, and the presidency. That to me would be devastating. They say, well, it's easy for people to visualize. If you had Hillary and a strong Democrats and Republican in the House and the Senate, that would be very devastating. But if you had, you know, a Republican president, and if you had the House and Senate, I think that's when the Republicans are the very worst. So I would be much happier with a Democrat president if the Republicans are going to maintain control. But, you know, everybody's hoping and wishing and praying that, well, Donald Trump is a little bit different and he's going to stand up to this. And, of course, I've come to the conclusion that not likely. He's disruptive, and that is good. But philosophically speaking, they all are endorsing very similar ideas when it comes to government force.
Yeah.
Some are worse than others, but they're all authoritarians. And, you know, one thing I noticed, I don't know if you've noticed this, is there was a time when, and I'm not taking credit for this, but there was a time when authoritarianism wasn't used very much, but I've always liked it and I've used it. I see the word popping up all the time now. Oh, he's an authoritarian, and I like to use that word because I think it tells something without telling them what kind of an authoritarian. And that's why, yeah, they asked me, do you like Trump or Hillary? I said, well, how can there be any difference? They're both authoritarians, you know.
What's to choose?
Yeah, they're nothing. So there isn't. And that's what the American people have. And of course, there's a high demand for authoritarianism if you're under the belief that authority is going to help take care of their special interests, whether it's the military-industrial complex or the poor who have been impoverished by our stupid economic system. Yeah, we need somebody to take care of us, you know, and we're entitled to it and we have a right to it. But that's the driving force.
All right, Ron, just for fun, I'd like to play devil's advocate here with you. But before we do that, let's pause to thank our sponsor. I often get asked, what else can I listen to when I've run out of Tom Woods Show episodes? What other libertarian podcasts are out there? Well, make sure and check out the Jason Stapleton program, hosted by my friend Jason Stapleton. Monday through Friday, he gives you a one-hour podcast, a one-hour libertarian overview of current events. So if something happens and you wonder, what's the libertarian take on this? And you say, how come Tom Woods isn't doing an episode on this? You can be sure Jason Stapleton is doing so. Jason has a knack for explaining complicated questions in ways that the layman can understand. Jason's been a guest of this program. He's been a good friend of this program, which he has boosted in many ways. And he is an excellent source to go to if you want to stay informed on what's going on in the world and if you want to have a libertarian take on events taking place around you. Jason is one of the great, reliable, consistent content creators in the libertarian world. Check him out at jasonstapleton.com. All right, let me play devil's advocate here a little bit. You were, over the course of your career, attacked obviously unfairly by the Israel lobby. And here you have Trump, who, on you know, out of one side of his mouth, he says, "I'll be the best friend Israel ever had." But then, out of the other side of his mouth, and more frequently, like in the debates, for example, he says, "We need to be even-handed. We can't go into negotiations saying that one side's an angel and one side's a devil." He's being pounded for this by Cruz and Rubio for dissenting from the orthodoxy. And I just read an article in the American Conservative magazine that basically said that every single primary Trump wins, despite not saying the approved things about Israel, is another nail in the Israel lobby's coffin. Isn't that at least something?
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that, because that's exactly what happened. It was amazed me when I discovered that years ago, that if you talk about even-handedness, that was anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
So, which is, you know, really bewildering. But you pointed out that, you know, he had two positions in every in his speech about what he'd do on foreign policy. But everything is that way. I love these people. I think Mexico are wonderful people.
Yeah.
But we got to lock them up, and we got to chase them home and put them behind, you know, that sort of thing. So I think what he is, but he's smarter than heck. He has a political instinct. He knows every single group who has felt injured. So he has a populist instinct, but and I think libertarians can be populist and offer liberty to solve the problems of the indigent. But he has a political instinct and a populist instinct that he knows all the groups, everybody who has felt that way. So as long as he throws it out there, so there are some, there's obviously now maybe his perceptions obviously are that it isn't the worst thing in the world to say, that it's decent to be even-handed, you know, with the Palestinians, which seems awful decent, you know, to say. But but I think he's just thrown it out there. I don't think he has convictions other than, you know, galvanizing everybody who's unhappy. And there's a lot of different groups out there, so he's going to say a lot of different things, and he's going to say a lot of different things in the same statement. He's the opposite of a libertarian who has a precise viewpoint and think that, you know, the solution is in the world of ideas, and you have to know what they are, and you have to, you know, be consistent, and it's a benefit to everybody because we deal with individuals. We don't deal with groups of people. We don't have contests between, you know, Asian Americans and Hispanic Americans and Black Americans and, you know, all this. That's not the contest. The contest is to provide liberty for people and bring these people together. But what you hear from Trump is exactly opposite of that. So I don't know how anybody can be reassured by what he says. And I think that people should be cautious when they say, well, it's wonderful because he's going to destroy the Republican Party. Well, I'm not going to argue with that, but what's going to be the replacement? You know, is he going to be him as a dictator? I mean, I've argued that, you know, Hillary wants to make the government very, very big and bureaucratic. Donald Trump just wants to become the government. he doesn't want to have to deal with anybody else, and he has indicated that. You know, the executive orders are in place, preemptive war is in place, and he can say and do anything he wants as long as he says something nice about every single group that exists. And then they say, oh yeah, but he said this, and he'll take care of us. So it's a mess. But I think this all comes about by the refusal of all the candidates in most of the country admitting the dire straits that we're in, that this country is totally bankrupt morally and financially, and they don't know how, well, they suspect how bad it is, but they don't want to deal with it. They don't want to say, you know, if you, let's say that some of us, and probably including you, that are saying we're in bad shape, this thing's going to fall apart. Well, you don't get a whole lot of votes for telling the truth about that, so they have to say something else. And they're total denial. I mean, how often have we heard in this debate that there's $210 trillion of unfunded liabilities, and this is going to come down on our heads, and it's going to destroy our liberties and your financial well-being, and that the foreign policies is going to come unglued? So that doesn't get you anywhere in the Republican primary or becoming president. And the only thing that does is to continue the facade, you know, this fake understanding of what's happening. So they haven't even come close to dealing with the precise problem, the end of the Keynesian era. I think this is really big stuff, you know, that we are ending a situation of 100 years of, drifting along with, you know, progressivism and the end of an economic system that is not viable. And I think Keynesianism is no more viable than communism and socialism. And yet, what are we talking about? More authoritarianism, and even people who call themselves are socialists, you know, are doing well. So I think it's put a lot of pressure on us who believe in liberty and a different economic system, a lot of pressure. But I think we're going to have a tremendous opportunity, because this is going to fall apart. And if we've done our jobs and get enough people to understand that there's an alternative, and it's not that painful to, go toward a libertarian society, and people say, well, no, you have to sacrifice. I don't think you have to sacrifice anything. If all of a sudden we say we're going to let you keep everything you earn, we're going to get a government out of your pocket and out of your bedroom, and we're not going to fight these wars, who sacrificed anything? The only people that would have to sacrifice are the beneficiaries, like the military-industrial complex and the big bankers. So as bad as it is, and they won't talk about it, I think the solution out there is not all that difficult to figure out.
All right, let me let you go on this note. Final question from listeners. Given that we've just talked about that and bankruptcy and everything, what's the most positive thing happening in the world right now, in your opinion?
I think the most positive thing from my viewpoint of having been involved for a long time is the excitement with libertarian ideas. I don't consider myself all that important about it, but I do get invitations. I've been to Brazil. I've been to Mexico. I've been to Chile. I get a lot of invitations to Europe. Yesterday, I was walking on the street in Georgetown in D.C. Somebody came up, and he was really, really excited, but he had an accent. And he was visiting here from Poland. You know,
oh, great.
There's a great group, obviously not the majority over there, so it's there. But I think the work you have done, and with the Mises Institute, they have done a lot of good. So I think we're way ahead on ideas, and nobody knows about it. And the ideas are the only thing that counts. So there's a lot of seeds planted out there. We have no idea how big the remnant is, and how big it's growing, and how many people are joining us. But compared to my getting interested in this in the 1960s, and certainly in the 1970s, it is so much better. And now with it falling apart, I'm crossing my fingers, but I'm hoping that a lot of good will come from this. But that's why I think what you're doing, Tom, is great. And I want to mention especially what you have done in working with us on the curriculum. Ultimately, I've had, my oldest son, Ronnie, he's been involved, and he's aware of all this. But he says, Dad, he says, what I think is going to be the most important thing is the Ron Paul curriculum. He says,
that's
going to change things. And it's slow, but it's sure, but it's going to last. And that's why your effort in education is so fantastic.
Well, thanks, Ron. I do want to mention, since you mentioned that Daniel McAdams, who, of course, co-hosts the Liberty Report with you, was telling me the other day that his own son is enrolled in the Ron Paul curriculum, and he's taking courses that I prepared, and that he's just glued to it, and he's fascinated by it, and he doesn't want to be distracted with anything else. He wants to be doing his studies.
Yeah.
And Daniel was so thrilled at this, and I thought, well, that's a great testimonial.
Yeah, but he was kiddingly telling me that he's not too happy with that, because when I want him to mow the lawn, he won't give up studying. He keeps reading this Tom Wood stuff. And I think, and when you think about what's going on in the public school, how many people don't want to leave school because they're having so much fun?
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's that one individual, can't think of his name, that wrote a book that public schools are a prison. People are there and they're forced in, and they're not there.
Oh, probably John Taylor Gatto.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
It's a prison. But that's the opposite of it. Of what it's like when you really enjoy learning. I can remember, of course, in college, I took an economics course, and it was one that wasn't required, but I wanted to learn more about it, and it was so terrible. When I discovered Austrian economics and realized there, that you didn't have to run computers and have formulas and have it dehumanized, that when I discovered human action and what goes on in a real economy, I was just so, you know, so fascinated with this, and it was became fun for me. And that's what people have to do. Education is the saving grace for us, but it's exciting if you discover it, and economics is far from boring if you can find the right books to read and the right philosophy to follow.
I'll just say as I let you go that you've been a model for me in a lot of ways, but you're also a model in retirement, because when I'm so-called retired, yeah, I also want to have a daily show, and I want to have an institute. Like I want to be doing all kinds of things and riding my bike. That's what if I retire just to play golf, somebody just please come over and smack me in the face.
Yeah, you know, my wife Carol said, "Why don't you retire?" And you know, some days I'll say, "Oh, I gotta go. I have two of them." And he says, "Why don't you retire and quit doing all that?" I said, "I'd be so miserable." I wouldn't do it. She said, "Well, you can just do this and this and play golf and all that." And I said, "No, that wouldn't satisfy me. No, I'm very happy with my opportunity that I've had both. See, I feel very grateful. I've had this opportunity to practice medicine for a long time, which I loved. Government has ruined that love of medicine for a lot of people. And I've had this chance to voice my opinion, in politics, and feel pretty good that I wasn't corrupted by that. Matter of fact, the longer I was in Washington, the more anti-Washington I became. So I thought that was a healthy move. So I feel very blessed.
Well, thanks so much again for all your hard work, and I look forward to the next time we are able to talk. Thanks again.
Very good, Tom. Thank you.
All right, everybody. Remember that today, March 14th, 2016, Bluehost is starting its special sale on web hosting all week long. So I've told you, if you want to start a website, wait till today, wait till this week, so you can get their $3.49 a month special deal on hosting. See, I find out about these sales in advance, and I pass on that inside information to the good listeners of this show. If you use my affiliate link, you get all kinds of great bonuses, video tutorials, help you become a really effective blogger quickly, but also free publicity for your blog, and a great price because of this special deal. So check it all out at tomwoods.com/publicity, and do it this week so you can snag that special deal. Karen Kotowski was a very, very popular guest on this show last week. Everybody just absolutely loved her. She is coming back on by popular demand for an encore appearance on the show, and we're going to talk about how she went from well, we're going to talk about her intellectual evolution. It's going to be very, very exciting. I was so glad to have her on last week talking about what was going on, cooking the books with the intelligence before the Iraq War. And to have her on again is going to be a real treat. So do please watch for that. And finally, remember, free ebook. Now, we're running out of time to bash Bernie Sanders because before you know it, he'll be out of the race. And his ideas are toxic and terrible and would be disastrous. So I've got a free ebook for you called Bernie Sanders is Wrong, and you can get it over at BernieIsWrong.com. Don't forget, grab that baby. It covers all kinds of topics, and it's going to give you a lot of ammunition so that when you're surrounded by Bernie supporters, you will be able to take on 10 of them with just your one brain. All right, thanks for listening, everybody. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.